Take me where the promises are real.
Y'all ready? Let's have an AA meeting.
Let's have one.
My name is Mike Boatwright, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on the passage from the page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in their personal stories describe their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing.
Hi, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Greg J. is going to tell the story, and he told it a few years back and blew me away. He typically sits back over here at the 545, and when he shares, or at least when he shared when I was a newcomer, he would tell it like it is. I mean, he would put his heart out on the floor, and he walked out of here and he didn't take a drink. And came back the next day, and he's still a member of the 545, and so glad to introduce my friend, Greg.
Okay, I'm Greg. I'm a real alcoholic.
Hey, Greg.
Oh, wow. I'm going to be a little nervous, but all in all, it's a pleasure to be here. It's always an honor to be able to share my story. That it may touch somebody, they may feel something, hear something, they can see something that they can relate to. I'll start with, I'm from Gary, Indiana, born and bred. I'm a Hoosier, love my basketball. You know, Indiana is a basketball state. It's like Georgia is a football state, but that's another conversation. I grew up with a mother and father, very loving, very giving parents. I have 8 siblings. I'm the 6th born, and my dad had 16 kids in all. So I got a lot of stepbrothers and sisters that I barely know. I don't know them well. I've met them over the years, but there's no relationship there. But coming from a large family is, some people say it's a blessing, some say it's a curse. I choose to think it's a blessing. We're close knit. My dad died about 8 years ago. He died in 2010. Basically worked himself to death. He worked in the steel mills in Gary after moving from Bessemer in Livingston, Alabama in the early 50s. And a hard-working man, hard-living, womanizer, and he was alcoholic. He wasn't a everyday drunk. He was one of them weekend warriors. When he got paid, that was the time for him to tie one on. And when he came in the house, everything got quiet. But he got loud. And verbally abuse, and physical abuse, too. I mean, we couldn't lock him up for the abuse he put on us, but he ruled with iron fists. He didn't take no stuff, and he was very encouraging, but he was very relenting in his way of living and how you should do things. And he instilled in me at a young age, hard work pays off, and if you want something, you got to earn it by the sweat of your brow. And he was a good man, though, you know. Through it all, he just had his drinking problems, and he was very relenting in the fact that he wanted the best for us. He wanted the best for his children. He really did. I tend to be the one that was most like him, even though I didn't want to be like him growing up. Because who want to work in the mill all your life? You know, who want to be a weekend drunk? But the same characteristics that he had, I had, because I came just like him. Womanizer, running the streets, partying every night, living that lie. And that's all it was. I lived growing up in Gary. The streets were tough. They call it the murder capital of the world for a reason. There's still murders there, and there's nobody even practically there. The town is literally a ghost town, but it's still rough. The economy is shot. The city's dead. But I moved here after stumbling around, going into the military. I joined the Marines when I was 19. I couldn't finish basic training because I came down with ulcerative colitis, and which is lame in terms, just bleeding ulcers. And so I didn't finish basic, but I was just trying to get out of Gary. I did anything to get out of Gary. I was a great basketball player growing up, and that made me one of them arrogant jocks. I could kind of play my way out of anything, especially when it came to sports. And I thought I was above it. I didn't like going to class. All I did was like playing ball. And I put all my eggs in that one basket. And when that basket broke, I broke. I didn't finish the high school that I started at. I ended up transferring to another school across town. Let me start over. Because when I first come out of elementary school, I got integrated to a predominantly white school. That was back in the 60s when they were doing the transition of segregation, and it was rough. Coming from the hood and going out into the suburbs was different. I was like a culture shock because I wasn't used to being around white people. I just wasn't. I mean, me and Pat Collins, only two blacks in a third grade class, and it was a trip, but it was a learning experience, and I really enjoyed it because I got to meet different cultures, Irish, Jewish, Germans, Polish, Italians, you name it, and they welcomed me because I was a jock. I was good at sports, and a lot of the kids that knew me, they knew that I was, you know, one of those that didn't take no stuff. I spoke my mind. You know, I shared from my heart. And I left it all on the table. But by my junior year in high school, I was smoking so much herb. I was smoking like a chimney, man. And, you know, the white guys, they had the best weed. I mean, they really did. They had the best of everything, really. Like I say, coming from the hood, you know, I never seen a three-car garage. I never seen a swimming pool, basketball courts on every garage door. It was a culture shock. And it was gratifying in one aspect, but it was like painful in another because I would have to leave that environment from school and come back home. And a lot of my buddies were like, they thought I was a traitor or something, you know, like I had abandoned them or, you know, or, but they weren't my choice, it was my parents' choice. I mean, they the ones that said I needed to go to this other school and get away from my playmates that I grew up with, the kids that I knew and loved. But like I said, it was a blessing because I got to interact with other cultures and see how they lived and how they were no different. They had the same issues and problems. They just had a lot more money. Their parents were well off, and they were white collar workers. Most of my kids I grew up, their parents were blue collar workers, and And it was a different time. I mean, times were slower back then. You know, the cost of living wasn't out of hand, and you know, you could earn a buck and you could spend a buck. But that being said, you know, the times we live in now are just so drastic and it's so changing, and we got a commander in chief that I don't know what he's doing. I don't think he knows what he's doing. But you know, that's a long statement. I mean, we can be here all night talking about our president. But that being said, he is not going to destroy this country. He's not going to divide us, even though I think that's what he's trying to do. But don't want to get into politics too tough. Like I said, coming up, going to a very prestigious high school that I eventually got kicked out of. On a field trip we had to Atlanta. It was a high Y and a Y team. It was a group of us. And I got in so much trouble here. It was crazy. I don't know how I ended up back living in Atlanta after what I did. And I did a lot. I mean, it was just a weekend, but they wrote up a dossier on the activities that I was embarked in. And I mean, I was doing some of it. I can't even remember half of what I was doing, but I know it wasn't nothing good, because I ended up getting expelled from high school because of it. And ended up transferring from New Wallace High School to Gary Emerson High School. And Emerson was just the total opposite of New Wallace. I mean, it was like night and day. It was in the hood. They had a lot of gangs. It was a depressing environment. And I don't know how I ended up there. I know how I ended up there. The coach talked me into transferring because he knew my athletic powers, and he thought that I would be a good fit with his team to help these young 7-foot kid, and he had a 6'11 kid and a 6'9, but they were just as clumsy and dumb as they could be, and they didn't know how to play no ball. So he thought that I could come and school them, which I eventually did, but I never played a lick of ball at Emerson. All I did was drink and drug and skip school and hung out all day. You know, my parents always wondered, how can you go to school and never have a book? They never saw me with a book in 2 years that I went there. And it's a miracle that I even graduated, because I don't know how I graduated, because I never went to class. But because I was a good ball player, I guess they let a lot of stuff slide. And like I said, being an arrogant jock, I never took into account the physical abuse that I was doing to myself. Like I said, when I went into the service, I came down with these ulcerative colitis, and a lot of that had to do with my drinking, but a lot of it had to do with what I also suffered from. It's called manic depression, a bipolar disorder, or you can call it tripolar disorder. It's a disorder, but nevertheless, it is something that I had to deal with ever since I was a teenager. And dealing with that, and the fact that I was an alcoholic, and I am an alcoholic, I never wanted to admit that I was an alcoholic. I guess I didn't want to be like my dad, but I ended up being just like him, like I said. And lo and behold, come down with another illness on top of it. So I would self-medicate myself when I wasn't drinking. I was using all kind of street drugs and anything I can get my hands on, just to run from the responsibility that I had an illness that I didn't want to face. And it took me a long time to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic. And I did suffer from a mental disorder. And this mental disorder has kept me in a lot of peculiar places, in and out of institutions and jails, and just doing some crazy stuff. That, wow. It kept me running from me. It wasn't until I moved here in 86 that I finally started looking at my illnesses and what can I do about them. And lo and behold, I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to live right across the street here, and I met Tim. This was back in like 88, 89. Just trying to stay sober, just one day at a time. And it was a struggle at the beginning because I didn't know what to expect. I had been in and out of treatments and rehab, but I met an old timer here, and he gave me a big book, and he just told me to read it and stay in touch with him. He was Don Shears. I'll never forget Don. He was a good old guy, but he was crazy as hell. And he was kind of scary because he just had a way of keeping it real simple and telling you, not so much suggesting, he was telling me how this thing works, and that if you want what we have to offer, then you'll go through any lengths to get it. But I, like I said, I was kind of scared of the man because he had a reputation around here as just being a straight shooter. I mean, he didn't hold no punches, and he didn't care how you felt about it. But he was a good guy, and I had a lot of respect for him. And I did eventually ask him to be my sponsor. And he carried me to the 12 steps as best he could because I didn't know about the 12 steps. I didn't know about recovery at all. I just know I wanted to quit drinking and getting locked up and going through the cycle of being up one moment, being depressed another moment, being locked up, being afraid. Like I said, I come from a loving family, and I thank God for them because they prayed me into these rooms. My mom and my dad and my sisters and brothers, they were all very supportive of me. But I blamed a lot of my problems, as selfish as I was, on them, because I couldn't live up to the standards they had set for themselves. I couldn't live up to their standards for me because I was too out there. I had no goals or dreams. Once my basketball career kind of diminished, and when I left high school and, like I say, joined the service, running from one coast to another, and everywhere I went, I would get locked up. I would end up in somebody's jail or some institution and strung out on prescribed drugs, just as bad as being strung out on street drugs. Because I would over-medicate myself with some very powerful prescribed drugs like Thorazine and Prolixin and Haldol and Cogedin. And these are powerful drugs that can have you feel like a zombie after a while. You'd be like, is this helping me or is this hurting me? So I struggle. I have my struggles, and just recently, about 2 years ago, a young lady asked me, I asked her to be my wife, and she said yes, and I almost jumped in the lake when she asked me, when she said yes, because it was so rewarding and fulfilling, because I've been knowing this lady for close to 30 years, and it was just, I don't know why. She said yes after all the hell I put her through, but I thought she was just as crazy as I was. And beautiful woman, and I thank God for her, because without her, I don't know where I'd be. Like I say, she's been through all the trials and tribulations that I've been through, and she has never judged me, or she's never left me. Even though we had a breakup for about 4 or 5 years, or the incident that I got into with my mother-in-law, and my mother-in-law still don't care for me that much. I guess like most mother-in-laws, they don't think that I'm worthy enough to have her daughter. But I thank God my wife is who she is and not my mother-in-law, because we would have never got together. But it's just a beautiful thing to be in recovery and to be able to live a quiet, peaceful life. You don't have to look for the blue lights in the basement, and I ain't got to be running anymore. I'm settled. My clean date is March 26, 08. And that's my sponsor sitting right there. And he was so gracious enough to come with me tonight because I needed the support. I need support all the time. And I go to church every Sunday, and that's been real gratifying. I also got other illnesses. I mean, I've been going to Gamblers Anonymous, and that's been real helpful. And because I was a big-time gambler. In my wild sprees and my drinking sprees, I would gamble just like I was doing the drinking the drug. I would gamble the same way. I'd win big, and I'd lose big. And that's addiction in itself. Now I'm trying to let go of these cigarettes, and that's the worst of the worst. I think it's more difficult than the drink of the drug, because I was smoking ever since I was about 8, 9 years old, and been smoking ever since. And just had a doctor procedure this morning, and the first thing my doctor asked me, he said, "Are you still smoking?" And he asked me that like every 3 to 6 months, and all I could tell him is, "Yes, I'm still smoking. But I want to quit, and I'm going to need some outside help and the prayers and me praying and just letting go. Then I can honestly say that I'm clean and sober. Once I let these cigarettes go, I can truthfully say that and feel it and know that I am doing the right things for the right reasons today. But I just feel real grateful that that I found a room with Alcoholics Anonymous, the relationships that I've forged over the years, and the people that I've met. Because anywhere you go in this world today, you can find aid and that is comfort that you know that you're never alone. You don't have to do this by yourself. It is a weak program, and there is so much help out here today that it's comforting to know that you can do this. If a drunk like me can get sober, I believe anybody can. And it is very grateful. I'm very grateful. I'm extremely grateful to the rooms and to the predecessors and even the newcomers. Because it's not easy, but it is simple. And that's what I try to do. I try to keep it as simple as possible and go to my meetings and talk to my therapist and my psychiatrist and my pastor and the fellowship and the network that I have. I am a talker, but I don't like this kind of talking in front of a group of people, basically strangers, and telling the story is not easy, but it is. It is a relief. It is a sense of letting go and being honest, especially with myself. That's only when I need to be honest with between me and God. I don't try to sugarcoat anything. And like I said, my life is really an open book. During time, hard times, being in the penitentiary, on 2 separate occasions, and being from up north and being in the south, the chain gang here is not like the chain gang up north. It's a whole nother ball. But it's still prison. You're still confined, and your movement and your actions are being limited to the point where you're just a number. You're just a number, and they can care less. But that's where I know when my God came into play for me was during those times when I was alone or in isolation or in protective custody. It's when my God really came into play, because that's the only one I could talk to. When you're in a 6x8 and you're all alone, who else are you going to talk to other than yourself? I think that's when my God came into play and let me know that I didn't have to live this way. And to rely on his will, not mine. His will is going to be done. Because I can take my will and run riot with it. But his will is divine, and his mercy and his grace and it's a very soothing feeling to know that I'm not alone. I've never been alone, even though I felt real lonely at times, but that's because I was in some lonely places. It's hard to have friends and associates while you're in confinement. I mean, it's just, you can't trust anyone because you don't know what they're in there for, and whatever they're in there for, it ain't nothing good. But locking myself up, and that's what was locking me up. It wasn't the system, it wasn't the man, it wasn't the police or the judges or prosecutors. It was me. I had the key to my freedom, because the prison that I was living in was the prison I had up in my head. And that was the prison of, like I said, of isolation and loneliness. And that's where the drinking and drug came in so easily, because it gave me an out. I could feel different about myself. I had to look at myself. I could look at everything around me, but I didn't want to look at me and the role I played in it. So it has been a struggle, but it's not a struggle anymore. I thank God for that. It's not a struggle anymore. Like I said, I try to keep it as simple as possible and to do the right things. And I'm a caretaker. I take care of my mother. She's 88 years old now, and she's feisty as ever. And if you know about taking care of one of your loved ones, it's not an easy task. But it's very rewarding, because I get to see my mother. I'm 61 years old, and most guys my age, they don't even have their parents. So I'm blessed to still have my mother and able to see after her and care for her and love on her and give her all the attention that she needs. Because she's in those years where, she, like I said, she's feisty. She can be downright upsetting at times. I mean, she can be a pain in the butt. I mean, literally. But that's mom's, and she's the matriarch of the family. Most of my elderly relatives have passed on the glory, and she's still here. And you know, it warms my heart to know that I've done my due diligence in caring for her these past almost 13 years. And like I said, coming from a large family, I guess that's where they say the curse come in, because they look at me like I'm the Rock. And that's my nickname. That's what they call me. Most of the brothers and sisters that know me from Gary, that's what they call me, and that's what they still call me to this day. But I'm not a rock. I mean, I can be, but I'm not the rock that they expect me to be, especially my family. They live their life. They go, they travel, they do all these extravagant things, and they expect me to be there for my mother, which I'm there for. But we just had to have a family forum. About 3 months ago, my mom fell out of bed, and I happened to have been working that night, and it threw her for a loop. She had to go into the hospital for about 3-4 days, and then she had to go into rehab for about a week. And she stayed with my sister for about 2 weeks until she was able to come home. And it was a trying time, because I thought we was going to lose my mom. But by the grace of God, that hasn't happened, and she's back to her normal self now. She's, like I say, she's feisty, and she could be mean at times, but she's the most loving person I know other than my wife. I'm truly blessed to have two strong women in my life that really love me unconditionally. And it's not easy being married, and my wife lives with her mother and I live with mine, and we're trying to get a home, but it's difficult because I'm not really ready to leave my mom, because I have a brother that lives with as well, but my brother's not me. My brother, I don't even want to take his inventory, but he's a trip. He's a definite trip, and he's not me. He doesn't care for her the way I care for her. I know he loves her, but it's just, he's selfish. He's selfish and self-centered. He's very immature. He's my older brother, so I have to kind of take a step back sometime and evaluate why we're here. And sometimes he's not on board with it. He doesn't want to do his part. But that's on him. That's the cross he's going to have to bear at some point in his life. Because my mom ain't going to be here forever. And lo and behold, I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know what I'm going to do without her. But I know I have to carry on. And the time will tell that I can reflect back and look at the things that I've tried to do for my family, for my loved ones, for my friends, that, you know, just being there sometimes is the most important aspect. It's just trying to be of service, because that's all we are. We're none of the servants of God. He's the master. We're the student. And to do his will today is, like I say, it's not easy sometimes, but it is rewarding when you do his will, that you reap the benefits of it. And I can go on for a long time here, but I'm glad it's winding down. And but you know, it's a trip. It's a trip. This journey we're on, and the life that you live, it's so fulfilling. It's so gratifying when you do get to know yourself and to be yourself. For so long, I tried to be someone else. I tried to be that hip, slick, cool guy, the ladies' man, the gigolo, the player. Yeah, I wanted to be all of that, but that only got me in a lot of hot water and some mischief that kept me disillusioned on really who I am. And today I know who I am. I'm just a son of God. And I try to do his will, like I said, in everything I do. And by his love and his grace and his mercy, he's bestowed upon me. He's allowed me to sit up here and tell my story to a group of people that hopefully I'll get to know better after the meeting. Am I talking up long enough, Chan? Yeah. Okay. Well, I just wanted to thank you all for having me, you know, let me share my story with you. And it's been heartwarming. It's been real. And I just hope that, you know, that we can just keep coming back and keep living this life. And it's a good life. It's a beautiful life to live when you're not drinking and drugging and worried about things that are not in your control anyway. Because I was a worried ward. I used to worry myself to death over things I had no control over. And today, I don't worry as much. I'm concerned about things, but I'm not worried, and I haven't broken down. That's a big deal for me, man, because I'm usually very emotional about when I share my story, because I had to suffer a lot, and it hasn't been an easy road to toe, but it's been my road, and it's been my pleasure to be here. I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Something that set me free, and I do love to move in harmony. See love as a vision that one day. Take me where the promises are.